welcome back. This is Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Up to Date wants to know what you're talking about with family and friends. Text UTD to 816-601-4777 to tell us. That's UTD to 816-601-4777. And I've got to add that standard texting rates apply. Well, a Cole County judge has ordered the Missouri Attorney General's office to pay a $12,000 fine for violating the state's Sunshine Law. This occurred when Josh Hawley, now the state's senior U.S. senator, held the office. The judge ruled that the office under Hawley knowingly and purposefully broke state public records laws. Joining us now to talk about this is Steve Vockrott. He's the investigative editor for NPR's Midwest Newsroom. Steve, always good to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into the ruling, let's get up to speed on this case. What lawsuit did the judge rule upon here?
So this was a lawsuit brought by the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee. Late in 2017, they filed a records request for communications between employees of the Attorney General's office and a political firm called On Message. At first, the committee was told by the Attorney General's office, we don't have any of those records. So then they filed a records request again in March 2018. And the Attorney General's office responded basically saying, it's going to take us a long time for us to get the records. And then they never ended up producing them until this lawsuit was filed. But then something happened in 2018 in October. There was a story in the Kansas City Star, which I had a little bit to do with in the reporting, that got we obtained the Star reporters obtained those records. And what they showed was that Josh Hawley had hired this On Message firm to basically shape and influence the activities of the Attorney General's office, which and that's as Josh Hawley was getting ready to run for Senate. So the cat kind of got out of the bag at that point. And this lawsuit was filed. And there was also an investigation done by the Secretary of State's office that turned up these records through that process as well.
And so that's what the records ended up being about, Josh Hawley and his campaign and everything else.
Right. And they were arguably embarrassing to him because for two reasons. One, he ran in 2016 for attorney general. He ran these ads saying, I'm not one of these Missouri politicians who just is going to use political office to seek higher political office. But then that's what he did. And the record showed that quickly after he got elected to attorney general, he started that process of getting ready to run for higher office where he sits today.
So what's the consequence then, Steve, of the judge's ruling here?
So the judge's ruling does a couple of things. A, it shows that he was not impressed by what the attorney general's office did in this case. One of the things they did is they used private email addresses, which effectively concealed the existence of these public records.
Right.
And you might remember that Josh Hawley was critical of Hillary Clinton when she was Secretary of State for using private servers for her emails. So there's that. What the judge also makes clear here is that public officials cannot excuse themselves from producing public records to the public when they ask for them just because they use private email addresses.
And that's a significant development.
That is. I have long suspected, and there have even been a couple of times where I've requested records that are on public officials' private email addresses, and the government tells me, well, we don't have access to their private emails. Well, what the judge makes clear here is there's no distinction between this server or that. If there's public business being discussed, whether it's a public or private email, those are public records.
And so going forward, you have that in your quiver as an argument to make against public officials who say, hey, we can't turn over records because private servers were used.
I will be reminding government officials of their obligation.
So what does it say about whether governments in Missouri can use private emails and servers then to sidestep the Sunshine Law? You're saying this sort of does away with some of that.
It should, because the judge made it clear here that it would be too easy for them to just sidestep their obligations if they just said, well, this is on a private email.
Yeah.
Private emails that discuss public business are public records. And any government official listening to this show should keep that in mind.
What happens next here?
Well, the Attorney General's office will have to cut a $12,000 check to the this committee that filed the lawsuit. But not only that, they're going to submit their legal bills, this group that brought the lawsuit. They're going to send their legal bills to the judge, and he's going to have the attorney general's office pay for those too, because he found that they knowingly violated the law.
Okay, that's KCUR Steve Vockrot. He's investigative editor for NPR's Midwest Newsroom. Steve, always appreciate it. Great job reporting, as
Thank you.
Always.
Appreciate it.
This is Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. I'm Steve Kraske. Around these parts, we know Bo. That's Bo Jackson, who played for our Kansas City Royals for parts of five seasons from 1986 to 1990. During those years, the legend of Bo Jackson grew to Paul Bunyan-esque proportions. There was the throw where he threw out the speedy Harold Reynolds at home plate on a line drive off the left field wall. There was the home run and the stolen base in the All-Star game, where he became the only player besides Willie Mays to do both. Then, of course, there was the idea that Bo played both professional baseball and football during those years, and he was a winner of the Heisman Trophy. Jeff Perlman has chronicled all this, including the time he almost choked fellow Royal Kevin Seitzer to death, in a new biography, The Last Folk Hero, The Life and Myth of Bo Jackson. Jeff Perlman is the author of 10 books, including Showtime, about the Magic Johnson-led Lakers that became the terrific HBO series Winning Time. He's also the host of a very good podcast, Two Writers Slinging Yang, and he joins us now. Jeff, what a pleasure to have you. Thanks for taking some time.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You know, this book is such a great read. I want to begin with the story you tell in here about Bo Jackson's time with the Royals, and it's about a photograph. It's June of 1986. He's just signed a contract to play professional baseball with the Kansas City Royals, and Bo is in the locker room of the Royals. It's empty. It's before a game. He's passing out 8.5 by 11 glossies of himself with the Heisman Trophy. Again, it's locker room nearly empty. It's before an afternoon game, but Bo is leaving these photographs on the chairs of the players. How well did that go over?
That did not go over well. He might as well just brought a dead skunk into the locker room. It would have gone over better. These are, you know, the Royals were a veteran-laden team, so you're talking about Willie Wilson and George Brett, Frank White, and Hal McCray in particular was 40 years old, and he was the DH on the team and future manager. And he followed Bo around the locker room. Bo was putting an autographed Heisman photo on everybody's locker, and Hal McCray was following him around, basically throwing him up in the air. And before long, everyone was throwing their autographed Bo Jackson photos up in the air. Is this a really bad read of the room from a 23-year-old kid, maybe thinking people would be a little more impressed by him than they were?
I was going to say, why did Bo Jackson, Jeff, why did he feel the need to distribute these photographs?
Because, like many of us coming out of college, he thought higher of himself than probably, if he was warranted. And, you know, he didn't read the room. Like, your major league players are very hard to impress athletically, and they don't care if you're a Heisman winner or an Olympic gold medalist or whatever. They're accomplished, too. And the idea of, like, I'm going to come to your turf and I'm going to peacock around, it just didn't go well.
You've titled this book The Last Folk Hero. Why is Bo Jackson the last folk hero?
Well, it's a term I stole, I mean, with approval from Joe Posnanski, who a lot of Kansas City people know.
You bet.
And Joe wrote a lot about Bo, and he actually used that term, the last folk hero. And he used it, I think, specifically in reference to the throw against the Mariners when Bo threw out Harold Reynolds.
Right.
And he was saying how if you watch the video of that throw, it was basically shot with one camera in Seattle, and you never see Bo release the ball.
Yes,
like, you never actually see it leave his hand. And he just played in an era pre-TikTok, pre-Twitter, pre-cell phones, where you had to take a lot of things as gospel or by word, and they almost sound mythological. For example, we know he ran a 4.13 40 at Auburn, but there's no video of it. We know he ran a 4.17 40 on grass in pads with the Raiders. No video of it. On and on and on. But we have enough. Like, everyone can see. You can go on YouTube right now and see him climbing up the wall in Baltimore. So,
right.
And you can see him. You can see the end result of the Harold Reynolds throw. So we see enough that we know the folklore makes sense, but we don't see it all. And nowadays, you see everything.
You know, I was dancing around YouTube last night looking for the throw. I've seen it before, but this throw to catch Harold Reynolds we're talking about. And I came across this interview with Harold Reynolds years later, who called it simply the greatest play in the history of baseball because he thought Bo Jackson had no chance of getting him. And I mean, what struck me about watching that video, Jeff, is Harold Reynolds is a fast guy, and he is flying around the bases. He started off at first base, and the fact that Bo Jackson was able to catch him at home plate just by the closest of plays, it is almost unbelievable.
I would say it is unbelievable. I would take away almost. It is. First of all, Harold Reynolds had a jump on the play. Like, he was stealing.
Yes. So yeah, he was stealing,
he was
right.
As soon as Harold Reynolds had led the American League in stolen bases. Like, he was a fast, fast man. The ball is hit to deep left. Bo just fields it and just wings it. He throws it a million miles over the head of Kurt Stillwell, the shortstop. The crazy thing is, on the replay, you see the Mariners' third base coach, Bob Didier, and their manager, Jim Lefebvre, coming out and screaming at the umpires. And the presumption is they're screaming at the umpires because they felt Harold Reynolds was safe. But I talked to Bob Didier, the third base coach for Seattle, and he said he didn't know if he was safe or out, but the umpire was 30 feet up the third baseline. He wasn't in the right position. And the reason he wasn't in the right position is the same reason half the Royals bench was walking into the clubhouse.
Right.
And the reason Bob Boone, the catcher, initially gave up on the play, because nobody thought there was any chance of Harold Reynolds being thrown out. So everyone just gave up on it as soon as the ball reached the corner, and then this miraculous throw happens.
Well, it is fun to watch on YouTube. I mean, the fact that you say he's a last folk hero, to me, suggests, you know, we've lost something in our society, because there's something to be said for folk heroes, isn't there?
I think so. It's kind of funny. I've been talking about this. Like, there's a story in the book when Bo was at McAdory High School, and everyone kept telling me there's this play where he hit a ball so high that by the time it came down in left field, Bo is rounding third base. And I thought, that's preposterous. That does not make any sense. And more people kept telling me about it. And someone said, you need to call Eddie Scott. He was playing left field for Fairfield High that day. So I called Eddie Scott. And he's like, I swear it's true. And here's what happened, and blah, blah, blah. So it's a great story that I love. But maybe if we had video of it, it wouldn't be quite as great. Maybe a stiff wind caught the ball and the ball blew around. Or maybe it hit a bird. Or maybe who the heck knows? Like, maybe Eddie Scott slipped on the grass, and by the time he picked it up, you know, like, we don't know. And I love the retelling of the story a million times more than I probably would the video of the
story. That's great. That's great.
You know what I mean?
Such a great
point.
More fun. Yeah. And I should point out, you talked to a lot of people for this book. How many?
720.
Wow. But you weren't able to talk to Bo Jackson, save for one conversation you had when you first started out here. And it was actually a very good conversation. Tell us about that.
So when I first started working on the book in 2020, I sent Bo a couple of my other books and a note. And he called me one day, and we had a 30-minute chat. He was driving to get his wife a chopped salad, and he was in a good mood. And, hey, I got your books, and, you know, I really appreciate it. And, you know, he talked about what he was doing now and his life. And then he said, you know, I don't care. I don't have a problem that you're writing a book. I just personally, I get asked to do these things all the time. It doesn't really interest me. And that was fine. And I got really lucky because Bo had a book come out in 1990. It was a bestseller, number two on the New York Times list, called Bo Knows Bo. It was
right.
His autobiography. And it was done with Dick Schaap, journalist. And before Dick Schaap passed away, years before he passed away, he donated all the audio recordings, all the transcripts, everything to the Auburn University Library. And someone made me aware of that. And I'm pretty sure for the last 30 years, that stuff sat untouched, probably in a dusty, you know, box.
Right.
In the basement of the library. And for $250, they sent me all of it. It was miraculous stuff.
Wow.
I would say maybe 15% of the material wound up in the original book. So I had all this fresh, never before heard 28, 29-year-old Bo Jackson talking to Dick Schaap material to use. It was a for me.
You know, you mentioned Dick Schaap. Wasn't he connected with, like, every great sports book ever written between 1965 and, you know, 2005 or something like that? That guy was everywhere.
Oh, yeah. Jerry Kramer.
Jerry Kramer. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Instant replay. So how old is Bo Jackson now?
Bo Jackson is 60. He lives in Burr Ridge, Illinois. He is a grandpa, which is crazy. He you know, has a bunch of businesses. He's done very well successfully in the food sort of corner, food market. He hunts. He drives a Ford truck. He's financially secure. He has been married to his wife for more than 30 years. Very quiet, very sort of dignified life.
Oh, good for him. Because he had one tough upbringing, didn't he?
Oh, man. Bessemer, Alabama. He's one of 11 kids. His mom raised him, you know, without his father. His father lived across town, literally across town, with his own family and had almost nothing to do with Bo. Bo had a severe, severe stutter as a kid, was held back a grade, was so poor. It was all those kids in a three-room house, not three bedrooms, three-room. They had no running water. There was an outhouse a couple of feet away from the house, a tar paper roof. And, you know, he would go to school either in his sister's hand-me-down shoes or socks, just socks. And he would beat the crap out of classmates, steal their bikes, steal their lunch money. He got his nickname, Bo. His real name is Vince Edwards, named after Vincent Edwards, the actor from Ben Casey. And he got his nickname, Bo, because when he was a kid of about 12, him and a bunch of friends went to a neighbor's farm with the goal of beating up the biggest hog. And for three straight days, they just went, beat the crap out of this hog, went again, beat the crap out of this hog, for viciously mean. And a hog in the South is referred to as a boar hog. Boar hog, pronounced in the South, is bohog. So Bo stems from bohog because he beat up a bohog.
You know, he's known for these Herculean feats. You've talked about a couple of them here. You know, again, longtime fans of the Royals will remember the great Willie Wilson. You write in the book, Jeff, about Willie Wilson challenging Bo to a foot race over and over again after Bo joined the Royals. Bo wouldn't do it until finally one day he accepts the challenge. Describe for us what happened. And I should point out that, again, longtime fans will know this. Willie Wilson was crazy fast. He was the speed element of the championship Royals teams of the early 80s. That was his game. Tell us about what happened there.
So this was all year Willie Wilson is like, Bo, race me. And Bo's like, nah. He's like, Bo, race me. Nah. So finally, it's near the end of the season. They're stretching one day. And finally, Bo's like, fine. And Willie Wilson, pre-Bo Jackson, is probably the best athlete anyone's ever seen in a Royals uniform. I mean, he was a multi-sport star from Maryland, could have played college football, like a great, great athlete. And finally, they're all stretching, and Willie's like, and Bo Jackson's like, all right, man, I'll race you. So George Brett runs about 40 yards away, and when he drops his hat, they go. And Bo Jackson says to Willie Wilson, he says, I'll give you a 5-yard head start, which is so insane. And Willie Wilson's like, nah, F that, blah, blah, blah. Well, George Brett drops his hat, and it says, and Bo Jackson destroyed Willie Wilson, just absolutely destroyed him. And again, like, he was a 4.13 40 runner at 230 pounds. It is ridiculous how fast he was. He was an Olympic caliber sprinter if he had lost weight. I'm not just saying that. He was an Olympic caliber sprinter.
Wow.
If he had lost 20 pounds, we would be talking about him in the way we talk about whoever, Carl Lewis or, you know, Usain Bekele, any of the great runners.
You know, there's another story about Bo that I've heard before. I read it in your book, but I think most people can relate to it. It's a story about Bo Jackson in a swimming pool and him jumping out of the pool. Explain what he did there.
I mean, so he was just all kinds of freaky. He really was, like, as an athlete. Like, he once jumped over the hood of a Volkswagen just to see if he could. Growing up, he would jump over. His house was surrounded by a 5-foot fence, and to get out of the house so his mom wouldn't see him, he'd go to the front and jump flat-footed over the fence. So he had a lot of experience jumping. And one day he was at Auburn, and a teammate was the manager at a pool, at a housing complex with a pool. And Bo was standing in the pool, waist-deep water, bent his knees, leapt flat-footed out of the pool onto the lip. And if you don't think that's, if that doesn't sound hard, go try it and make sure you have a doctor nearby.
And what's amazing about all this is Bo Jackson didn't lift weights, did he?
No. Wait, I just wanted to say, to me, the craziest thing in a lot of ways, he didn't lift weights, he didn't swim, he didn't do any of this stuff. Like, his first major league at bat for the Royals is September 2nd, 1986. Steve Carlton on the mound. Bo Jackson's a raw rookie, and he hits a ground ball to second base to Tim Hewlett of the White Sox. He beats it out, and sitting behind home plate is Art Stewart, the Royals scouting director, and a bunch of other scouts. And he checks his stopwatch, and he doesn't believe it, so he turns to another scout. He says, "What'd you get?" Scout says, "I missed it." Turns to another scout, and "I didn't get it either." And Art Stewart says, "Because I got a 3-6." And the other guy's like, "I got a 3-6." And the other guy's like, "I got a 3-6." It was the second fastest in the history of Major League Baseball home to first by a right-handed hitter. And that was his first Major League at bat. And my favorite detail of that by far, it was against Steve Carlton, who is obviously a legendary pitcher.
Right.
And Bell had never heard of him. Had no idea who he was.
Yeah. Jeff Perlman's my guest. His new book on Bo Jackson, The Last Folk Hero, The Life and Myth of Bo Jackson. There's also another story about Bo taking batting practice. I think, Jeff, you can correct me if I'm wrong, for the first time with the Royals. And even at that moment, the great Reggie Jackson, who was playing for the Angels at that time, that was the Royals' opponent that night, came out early to watch Bo take batting practice in the cage. What happened that night?
Well, Reggie's watching it, and Reggie was not one to dish out compliments. He's actually really a pain and a pretty arrogant guy and not that fun to cover, but he's watching Bo Jackson, and Bo Jackson just bam, 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 bam. And that same session, all the other Royal power hitters are hitting, and they're hitting these dinky shots, and Bo Jackson is just nailing them. And Reggie Jackson is like, "This is a different kind of beast." That was his quote. "This is a different kind of beast." And then, as I was going to say, one time he was taking BP in Minnesota at the Metrodome, the old Metrodome, and he hops in left-handed. He just hops in left-handed.
Wow. Buck O'Neill, the legendary Kansas City Monarchs coach, manager, player, was so impressed. He said that he only heard the sound of a baseball being hit that hard a couple of times, once by Babe Ruth, once by Josh Gibson. That's saying something.
It's funny. I'm going to be honest with you. This isn't a sexy answer. I'm a little skeptical of that one because I covered Major League Baseball for a long time, and I heard Mark McGwire take batting practice and Barry Bonds take batting practice, and I also heard like F.P. Santangelo take batting practice and Mike Kingery take batting practice. I don't know. Like, I know that story's true. I know he felt that way.
Right.
Bo Jackson was definitely different. There's no doubt about it. He was definitely a different kind of player and a different kind of beast.
Right.
Does the ball really sound that different coming off of a guy that you could recognize it to, Josh Gibson and Babe Ruth?
Yeah.
It's an amazingly legendary, cool story. I'm not 100% convinced. Does that make me a jerk?
Yeah. So before you go, I've got to ask about Bo Jackson's issues with Kevin Seitzer, who was a really good hitter for a lot of years with the Royals, but also Kevin Seitzer could be a pain in the backside. There was bad blood between Bo Jackson and Kevin Seitzer, and one day Bo had enough, Jeff. Tell us what happened next.
First of all, I want to give you big credit for your use of backside. That was very nicely done.
Oh.
So Bo Jackson hated Kevin Seitzer. Kevin Seitzer, every clubhouse I ever covered as a baseball writer, has a gnat, which is a guy who's always poking, prodding, pain in the butt. And that was Seitzer. And one day they're hitting, and Bo Jackson, Kevin Seitzer, Ed Hearn, and Bill Pakoda was a hitting group. And they take their cuts together under the cage. One day Bo Jackson had to leave to get something. And he comes back, and Seitzer jumped in front of him in line. And Bo's like, "What are you doing?" He's like, "You left, blah, 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 blah." Well, Bo Jackson gets in the cage, and Seitzer starts needling him. And Bo's like, "You need to stop." He keeps needling him, and Bo's like, "Seriously, I'm giving you a last warning. You need to stop." And Seitzer did not stop. And Bo Jackson walks over, extends his right arm, puts it around Kevin Seitzer's neck, pins him against the wall, lifts him up against the wall, and Seitzer starts turning blue. And Bo Jackson's like, I told you. And the other Royal players, and the guys in the hitting group and the coaches, start running over there trying to pry Bo Jackson's arm off of Kevin Seitzer's neck. And finally, he lets him go. And later on, about an hour later, Seitzer comes up to Bo, and he's like, "Hey, Bo, are we good? Are we good?" And Bo Jackson, who always had that edge to him, was like, "Nah, we're not good. You do not treat me that way. You do not talk to me that way." And it created a real frost between those two.
Interesting. Great story. So many great stories in The Last Folk Hero, The Life and Myth of Bo Jackson. I can't recommend the book enough. Jeff Perlman, one of our great sports writers in this country. Jeff, what a pleasure to have you on the show. Best of luck with the book.
Thank you so much for showing it.
You bet. All the best. Up to Date is a production of KCUR 89.3. Our theme music was composed by the great Bobby Watson. The program is produced by Danny Alexander, Zach Wilson, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Reginald David. Our engineer is Paul Nakatura. I'm Steve Kraske. Thanks for listening.